Here trying to think about what I can say about my speaker today, and somebody suggested that I just get up and introduce the speaker and sit down and say, "This is Dave," but I really don't think that I want to do that because I've gotten to know this man a little bit this weekend, and I was terrified of him when I first called him because they told me that he didn't like to be disturbed at his summer home, and it was the end of August, and I was like, well, wait a minute, you want me to get in touch with somebody who doesn't want to be bothered at their summer home? And I was like, well, I wonder how long I can wait before he's not going to be at his summer home anymore. And I called him, and he said he was going to call me back, and he did. And he just told me that he'd be tall and he'd have a crew cut. And I said, well, that's great. I'll be tall and I have blonde hair. And he got off the plane, and I remember looking, and he kind of looked at me, and I kind of looked at him. And we just knew that, you know, that that's who I was supposed to meet. And I've just really enjoyed spending time with him this weekend. He's introduced me to a lot of wonderful people, and it's been truly an experience. And he's taught to me about service, and that's right where I need to be today. And I'm really excited about hearing from Dave. He'll have 38 years on September 12th. And so with that, here's Dave.
Now you know why I look that real good, don't you? Before I begin, I'd like to express my appreciation to the committee for having me out here this weekend, and Don Roy. And he's the man that asked me to come here many months ago. And it's good to be here and share with you and this wonderful weekend. I've been hanging around here since Thursday and listening to these people and been sitting up here about 35 minutes this morning. And some of you wonder how I feel. Let me tell you how I feel. It's related to a story I heard in my early sobriety. It seems as though they had a convention in my home state years ago, and they had one of these long-winded speakers. And he got up and started talking, and the first hour he talked about the 12 steps. Second hour he got into the 12 traditions. Third hour he got into the three legacies. And people began to leave. They will leave. I found it out one night. And sure enough, everybody left, but one man just kept sitting on the front row, kept sitting. And of course, the speaker got concerned. He rounded up his talk, ran down from the podium, and grabbed the man by the hand and says, I want to ask you one question. Everybody left but you. Why'd you stay? And he said, hell, I'm the next speaker. Well, you know how I feel now, don't you? Yeah. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Dave Cook. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I'm a member of the Big Book Group in Raleigh, North Carolina, which I think is the finest group in the world. And if you don't think the same thing about your home group, then maybe you need to find another one. I had to do that. By God's grace and because this program works for me, through the help of some understanding sponsors that led me with a kind but firm hand, through the love of a loving wife, that I found the results of this program, and through the help of many people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or any tablets since the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. That day was September the 11th, but my sobriety date is September the 12th. And for this, I'm very grateful. In 1957. I don't give my sobriety date to impress you. Sometimes it impresses me, I'll be honest. Where I came in AA, it was the old Central Group in Roanoke, Virginia. The second meeting I ever went to was one of these discussion meetings. And they had 13 or 14 wicker chairs sitting in a circle. And I'm no different from anybody else that goes to our first discussion meeting. I began to wonder what I was going to say when it got to me. And it finally got to me, and the man who has become my first sponsor, although I didn't know it then, He spoke up and told me what to say. He said, give your name and your sobriety date. That's all you're qualified to do. And as a matter of fact, after the meeting, he went a little bit further and explained to me that's probably what all I was going to be able to do for the next year, was to give my name and sobriety date. The old Central group was a rather strange group. They had some do's and don'ts. And I look back now, and maybe it was right for me. I know it was for me. They had a saying that if you got behind that podium in that group, if you didn't give your sobriety date, you usually didn't have one. And so that's the reason I give my sobriety date. Like so many of you, I've received a lot of benefits from this program. I don't know, sometimes I think of the material thing, you know, that what I call benefits such as peace of mind, serenity, a few material things, some happiness. But when I talk about these things, I think about basic benefits that I received. The basic benefit that I received beyond my sobriety, and of course the sobriety came first, is my sanity. My sanity. And today, as a sane alcoholic, I find now that I don't have to run anymore. I don't have to cheat or lie or steal anymore. And I don't have to sober up anymore. Now, I didn't know that was the name of the game when I got here to you. I was one of these fellows that grew up and had about everything you needed growing up. I knew what booze could do to a grown man because I saw what happened to my father at a young age. As a matter of fact, when I was 12 years old, my father and mother were divorced on account of his drinking. My father was an alcoholic. Now, I didn't know that until I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I didn't know anything about alcoholism until I got to AA. And I remember as a kid promising my mother that I'd never be like him. And I tried, but you know how it is. You get in these environments, and I went off to school when I was in college, and I got around these fellows who just come back from World War II, knew how to drink. I was in that environment, and it wasn't long before I was doing the same thing the big boys were doing. Had some problem in the beginning, getting it down. You know, we work at it. I used to hear them talking about, I was throwing up a lot, and I used to hear them talk about the pleasure that comes from drinking. I didn't understand what they were talking about. And one night I asked one of them, I said, when does the pleasure come that you speak of? And he said, Dave said, there's a little pause in between from the time you take the drink and when you throw up. That's the pleasure. And and it wasn't long. I cultivated a taste for it, went on through college and had I didn't have any problem with drinking that I can recall. I did some foolish things, got in some minor trouble, and didn't know what a hangover was. I studied engineering, and because of my basketball ability, when I graduated from college, I look at it now, and I guess I was seeking some glory. I was offered a job coaching high school basketball, in spite of my engineering ability, and I don't know, I decided I'd do it. And so I went out in the world to coach high school basketball and teach in the public school system in the state of North Carolina. Well, the first job I had, some kids that were older than I was. I was 20 years old when I started coaching. And had some success at it and fell upstairs in the coaching profession, went to a larger school. Now, my drinking in this time, I was just going back to on some weekends to meet some of my former classmates where we'd get these get-togethers and have a party and come back and work the week and then get together again. The weekends got more frequent, and wasn't long before when I got this second school, I found myself around school board members that drank every night. And so I became a nightly drinker. And it wasn't long before I found the morning drink after teaching school for about 6 years and coaching. And I began to have some problems. And, kids are very observant. And I was going to these ball games. I was drinking a lot of vodka. You know, it leaves you breathless, I thought, and you know, I wasn't drunk. I was just, you know, loose. You know how that is. Just free-flowing, in the middle of the year, this particular year, I had to take over this girls' basketball team. The coach had to go into service, and they asked me to coach the girls' basketball team. And I was going to these half ball games half boozed up, like I said, just loose and nothing outstanding that you could tell I was drinking. But if you smelt me real good, you knew something was going on. But just before the ball game started, I had these girls in the huddle, and I'd been used to these boys, you know, hitting them on the rear, getting them out there, giving them pep. You know what happened? I was patting them, and first thing I know, the parents came out of the stands, and we had a confrontation there, and I didn't know what was going on. I really didn't. And needless to say, the school board met the next morning, I'd already been in some trouble about doing some things that in the community. I know none of you have ever written any checks that were bad. Wrote a few of those, and the sheriff in the county would come out to see me. And you know, it's amazing to me our thinking in the roles we play as a practicing alcoholic. I can remember many a day that the sheriff would come out to school, and they had driving these big old Plymouth cars with those radio rolls that just waved all the time, you know, when they stopped. They just, to me, a radio roll has always been a sign of authority. And I would go out, he'd call me out of the classroom, go out the hallway and go outside and talk to him. I knew what it was. And as we were getting to go out, you know, kids were looking out the window, and the teachers were too. And my thoughts were, well, they don't know it, but I'm on the cover agent for the sheriff's department. things like that. I know none of you ever thought of things like that. It seemed like I always wanted to be somewhere else most of the time, wanted to be with somebody else most of the time, and doing something else when I was drinking. I really did. I decided I'd get some people off my back and divert their attention. You know how the alcoholic is. He's cunning, baffling, and powerful when he's drinking. And so I decided I'd get married. Maybe that would take the heat off. And I did. I met a girl in the community I'd known for about 2 weeks, and we got married. I got the attention. Got married on July the 4th. And this was a mistake from the very beginning. As they say in the Al-Anon program, the alcoholic affects everybody around him. And I affected this woman. We lived together. We knew we wasn't going to have this successful marriage from the very beginning after a few months. And because of the fact I was a high school coach and teacher and the embarrassment it would bring in the community, we got a divorce. We lived together for a year and a half. And she didn't know how bad I was, how bad off I was, and I didn't know how bad off I was, but everybody in the community knew I was a community drunk by now. And this is alcoholism. This is alcoholism. The day came that she wised up and got out. The day came that I was fired from this school that I'd been at for several years with a promising career ahead of me if I could have left the bottle alone, and I was told that. And in my home state, you just keep moving east, and you get out there to where you can't go nowhere. That's about what happened to me. I left this school. I had to resign, and I moved to another school. There was a rock bottom of school a little bit further east. I was able to last this school for about 6.5 months. And what happened? I had gotten to the point that I'd gotten to my drinking where I had to get up 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. I had it then where I'd drink enough to stop shakes, so I could get my clothes on, perform, and go to the schoolhouse, and invariably I knew what was going to happen around 12. The shakes would come back. I'd have some hit in the gymnasium or in the automobile, get enough booze to stop the shakes around noon, pray for 3 o'clock when I could get out of the automobile and drive back to town. It was a rural consolidated high school, and go by the AB store to beer joints and get loaded again. And it went on and on for 6.5 months. And then one day, this principal of the school just stopped me and said, "Dave, we don't need you anymore." I mean, we didn't even have a conference. We didn't even call me in the room and say, "Let's talk about this thing." He said, Give me the keys. I've looked back many times, and I really believe that from what I know now, through my sobriety and the program, that I had crossed that invisible line that we speak of, that I've become an alcoholic, although I didn't know it then. And to me, an alcoholic is a man or woman that takes one drink and can no longer guarantee you his or her behavior. And that's the way I became. I'd take one drink, and I couldn't guarantee you what was going to happen. Previous to this, when I came along, there were no such things as treatment centers. There were places called drying out places. That was what that meant. I never dried out. I went to a lot of them. My mother sent me up and down the East Coast to some famous places for my nerves. And I'd come back in worse shape than usually when I went. And most of these places, they had a program called, tapering off. I don't know if any of you ever tapered off or not. I enjoyed tapering off. You just sip a little and just it gets looser as it goes. You know that. Tapering off. But my mother found that she spent a lot of money on me, sending me all over. I got a sabbatical leave from school to go on these places for my nerves. But this particular day that this man fired me up, I left school that day, and I had experienced some blackouts before, for a short period of time. I'd never experienced a long blackout, but I don't know where I went. Later found out for a period of about 2.5 weeks. And I woke up in jail for the first time in my life in the city where I was living, down in eastern North Carolina, a place called Rocky Mountain. And one morning, a man came to the cell door and began to talk to me, and his son says, "We're going to send you to a place where they cure you. Your mother has come down here and straightened out all this mess." Now, my mother had straightened out a lot of messes. I had one of these mothers that loved me to death. And I just about died from it. But she'd come down and straighten out another mess, and they were going to send me to a place where they could cure me. In my home state, the state insane asylum is called Dix Hill. I've often said I, too, went to Dix Hill and found my thrill on Dix Hill. 26 years of age when I went to Dix Hill the first time. And as long as I draw a sober breath, I hope I never forget my first trip to Dix Hill. The first few days, they put me in a place called the inebriate ward. I didn't know what it meant, but it sounded pretty good. And I adjusted that environment, and it seemed to me, as I recall it, that most of the people chased squirrels most of the time. They'd run up in the ceilings, under the floors, and under the chairs. And so, if you're in Rome, you do as the Rome. I begin to chase squirrels, too. Got pretty good at it. Never caught one. Come close, but... And God, you look back at those things, and you wonder if it was really you. You really if it wasn't you. And then one day, after I'd been there a few days, they took me out of there. And you want to know what the treatment was? I'll tell you what the treatment was. I began to have delirium treatments and hallucinations and all that stuff that goes with it. And they carried me down to another building called the Edgerton Building, and where they had all their drunks. And they put me down in the... in the basement, in a cell. They call it Skid Row is what they call it. And it was a padded cell and took my clothes away from me and let me have my running fits. Days later, when I got through having my running fits, they gave my clothes back to me. And then I was allowed to do the only thing I could do for the next 30-some-odd days. I was walking up and down a corridor day in and day out, wondering what in the hell I was doing there. There was nobody there my age. The men were in their 50s. And, I began to think, as we do think, somebody made a mistake here. And I began to take the intelligent route. I began to think, well, I'm here to write a book. That's what it's all about, you know. One night, these older fellows were playing poker, and they were sitting in a circle, and they were using matchsticks for chips. And I heard one man speak up, and he says, I'm here because my wife put me here. She wanted to get rid of me. And I began to think, well, my mother wanted to get rid of me, and that's the reason I'm here. And then I heard a man speak up, and he says, I'm here because I'm an alcoholic. My God, when I heard that word, I thought of one thing. I didn't know anything about what an alcoholic was, but I thought about my father. And at that time, I was to play a game that was to plague me until after I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, compared my drinking with my father's drinking. And as the truth was known, he proved to be a much better man than I ever hoped to be in my act of alcoholism. He lost a family, but he didn't have to go to jail. He didn't have to go to those crazy joints. He didn't have to be put away from confined for a period of time, but I did. The day came that I had to leave Dix Hill, I didn't know what to do. Everything that I'd accumulated since I'd graduated from college, the cars, the homes, the wives, everything I had lost completely, didn't have a thing. And what do? You go back home to mama. About 28 years old, I go back home to mama. Just like your kid does when he comes home from school. And you get back home, you know, people ask you where you be. You know, you go home at that age for weddings, special occasions, funerals, and so forth, holidays. And people begin to ask, what you doing home? You don't tell them you've been to Dix Hill. No, no. I had another nervous breakdown. The good family doctor, who was a friend of the family, he was always worried about my nerves. He didn't know anything about alcoholism. He's retired now. He knows a great deal today. I got home, and I don't know a thing about drugs. I want that understood. Don't know a thing about drugs. But I do know something about tablets. The good doctor was worried about my nerves, and he gave me some tablets to take and told me how to take them, and I started taking them. And I was running around with a crowd at night that I'd been in school with, and they were drinking, and I was taking my medicine. And, I was in worse shape than they were most of the time. But after about 9 weeks, one night, I decided I'd have a drink. And I took a drink, and now, as I know the compulsion we speak of, it called for another one. And lo and behold, in a week's time, I was back in that place I'd said I'd never go again as long as I live, Dix Hill. Back to that goony roost again. To make a long story short, I went back to Dix Hill 5 times. In 6 months, on account of one fact, I'd become an alcoholic. I could not guarantee you my behavior. The last time I went back to Dix Hill, they put me in the nut part of the bug house instead of the drying out part. And there's a distinct difference. And this is where I found out about being tied down in a bed in a straitjacket, eating on your tongue. I found out how you live better electrically, too. There was an old fellow from Alabama, some of you knew him, dead and gone now, and I break no end in him, Pelham Green. And Pelham used to talk about those shock treatments. He says, I always felt better after I had one of them things. You damn right you'll feel better after you had one. Now, I look back at that, and it seems like a dream sometime, but I was over there in that part of that place with nuts, people, insane. And I began to accept my fate that I was going to be there. Maybe it was a coincidence. Coincidence is a word that we hear in this program quite often. But one day they came and got me and carried me back over to the old Ledston building and put me with the rest of the drunks. I'd been there so much, it more or less made me an honorary attendant. You know, I worked in the kitchen and worked in the cafeteria and let me do things like go and get the mail and so forth. And one day, two other fellows and I, myself, decided we don't want to sound dramatic, but we escaped. We ran like hell. And back then, it was like Cops and Robbers. It was like Cops and Robbers. I go by that place many a time now, and that I don't know how we got over that fence, but we came over it that day. And that afternoon, we were in downtown Raleigh, and old hotel's gone now. Sitting down there watching the 6 o'clock news, and they came on the flash and said there had been 3 criminals insane just escaped from Dix Hill. And we said, wonder who the hell it is. And and sure enough, I don't know where they got those pictures from, but they flashed us up there, and my God. Now, you talking about take some drinks. We took some drinks then, and we decided we'd better separate, and I'll never forget it. I was laughing, and one was crying, and the other one said, hell, I'm gone. And so we split, and the next morning, a man on the street that was a friend of my mother knew her, saw me on the streets, and I was trying to do a little panhandling, and he got me and put me on a bus and sent me back to my hometown down in eastern North Carolina to go back home to my mother. Now, I didn't know it. I got home, and my mother's on one of these big places, old Southern plantation home, and I didn't know it, but she was up in Richmond, Virginia, with a nervous breakdown. And I didn't know where she was or anything, but I broke in the house and got there and stayed there a few days until they brought her home and found me. And I was up there in the bed drunk, been living off some friends of hers. And that afternoon, after they got Mother home, they got together. I don't know who you know who they are or not, but in my case, it was my 2 sisters, a young'un and I, and a friend of the family was like a father to me. And my mother and, you know, they are those people that put you in one room, they go in the next and they crack the door. And they begin to talk about how much they love you, but what they got to do. And it wasn't long before one of them came in and began to talk to me and said, we want you to leave this part of the country. You're killing mother. And she had a wad of money. I began to think it was a good idea when I saw that money. And you know, there's nothing that a practicing alcoholic likes anymore than to get some green on his hip. And I begin to agree that I thought that would be the best thing. And so it was enough money to, I could have gone to the West Coast and lived good for a period of time. And I went 4 miles to a neighboring town. Pulled into an old broken down hotel and had a lot of friends for a few months. Drank a lot, and then the money ran out. Of course, when the money ran out, I'd done the same thing I'd always done before. I went over to my hometown one day. A friend of the family was in outdoor recreation business. I bought an outboard motor. I didn't have a boat, but I bought a motor. And, you know, give a big check, get a little change, and get on the way. And he had called my mother to tell her that my motor was ready. And she put 2 and 2 together. And that afternoon, John Law was over in this hotel and carried me back to my hometown and put me in jail. And God, I was down there in jail and stayed there for several days. Nobody came. Every drunk that came in there every night, they turned them out the next morning except me. I was raising a lot of hell down there one night and finally got the jailer down there. And he said, what's the problem? I said, I want to talk to my attorney. He says, who is your attorney? I told him who it was. He said, talk to him all you want to. He's the next cell block. And sure enough, he was. Well, that man later became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a member of our state legislature. He's dead and gone now, but he couldn't do me any good that night. And then one morning they started me upstairs, and I had to stand trial in court of law for that. Something I didn't know I'd done on a previous drunk. Now, you got to understand something. My mother's next door was the city solicitor, and he didn't seem to know who it was. My sister was city clerk, and she came into the courtroom and didn't even smile at me or nothing. And nobody seemed to know who I was, and they said a few words, and then they put me in a cage truck and carried me down the road further and to another courthouse. And the next day I was standing trial for something I didn't know I'd done on a previous drunk. Nobody came. And like I said, I went further east. In my part of the country, you go as far as you can, it's called a Great Dismal Swamp, just before you get to the ocean. I was put on a chain gang. because of one fact. I was an alcoholic, and I could no longer guarantee my behavior. I've been ashamed of it for a long time. Still ashamed of it. But for me, if it took this for me to get to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thank God for it, because I think it, you know, I'm one of these people that I had to be beat down to my knees before I could see myself. And that's the thing that I don't understand about alcoholism or the alcoholic today. After working with people, my own situation, people that I see come in right today. And that's the inability of the alcoholic to see himself as he really is in his worst moments. And this is the thing that just about destroyed me. And at this prison camp, I worked harder than I've ever worked in my life. And I got my smoking tobacco and soda pop by writing letters. I was the only man there with an education. Nobody in the family would have anything to do with me. And the superintendent of this camp was a young man that had a young wife, and he let me cut his grass on Saturday afternoon and let me have dinner with him on Saturday night. And Mary and I looked forward to this. And he would, one night he was telling me about, well, maybe my problem was alcohol. Maybe I should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd heard about AA one time before, and that was in Dix Hill. I was one of those fellows that have meetings on Sunday afternoon. People in Raleigh would come over and put on a meeting. And I was one of the fellows who got in the back of the room, raised hell while the meeting was going on, made fun of them. And you know, I was a few years sober before I figured out something. Maybe Sunday afternoon, those folks went on home. I stayed. But the day came that I left this place. I didn't have anywhere to go, and the only thing I could do was go back to my hometown again. And they carry you back, and I went back to my mother's home, and this time I went to the back door instead of the front door. I guess I was second class in my own mind. And my mother took me in again. And they got together again that afternoon. And even my brother-in-law came over this time. And, well, I won't get on that, but anyway, I heard Mother say, "That's my boy, and he stays here tonight, whether you like it or not." And that's when I made a vow that I'd try to do this for her. You know, now the word sobriety wasn't in my vocabulary. I just wouldn't drink anymore for her. And I don't recommend this before AA or after AA. And I was able to do this for a period of about 4 months. In the interval, after I came back home, my mother made arrangements for an old-timer in my hometown, one of the early pioneers in AA in my part of the country, carried me down to a place called Rich Square, North Carolina, to talk to Vernon Strickland. Vernon was a successful lawyer that became an alcoholic, came out to Cleveland, ducked Bob, got a hold of him, got him sober, and Vernon came back to Eastern North Carolina, started the first group in Eastern North Carolina down in Rich Square, and became a successful attorney again. He was our second state delegate. And J.T. carried me down and talked to Vernon one night, and this man sat down and bared his soul to me and told me about Alcoholics Anonymous and what it could do for me. And I told him I was too young to be an alcoholic. My brain had been about pickled by then, but I was too young to be an alcoholic. And I never forgot what Vernon told me. He said, "Son," says, "I'll tell you what you do. You keep drinking and be patient. And you'll find out." And so that's what I did. I didn't think I could get a job teaching the state of North Carolina after what I'd been through. But through an agency up in Richmond, I was interviewed in three states in a period of a week. My mother carried me to these places. And I'd been dry for about 4 months, and one day we round up on a Thursday afternoon in Roanoke, Virginia, and a man began to talk to me. It was the largest half school in Southwest Virginia at that time, and he got on the phone, and I gave him some references. I told my mother, I said, "It's all over now." And he came back, and he talked to me for a few minutes, and he said, "By the way," he says, "I understand you had a problem with drinking at one time that you're cured now." And some of these people that knew me thought I was cured, and I said, "Yes, sir, I am." "Well, we want you to go to work." And they were desperate, this latter part of August, about the middle of August. And so I had to go back to my hometown on that afternoon, and my mother financed this whole trip. I had a place to stay when I moved back to Roanoke. I had a new, fresh start in life in spite of where I'd been with the record I had as an assistant basketball coach and teaching mathematics in that school. And so on the way back, I had to go through Richmond and have a little change and buses. And outside, I'd have one drink, but I bought two pints. And this was the beginning of my last drunk, the only drunk that I really like to talk about, because this is the drunk that got me into Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got to Roanoke, I didn't go to the place. I had it was a beautiful place, and it was a private residence, and I went to the big hotel on the hill and began to live it up a little, and started school. I lasted 5 days teaching, and came Labor Day weekend. I went in labor, I guess, and finally the school people tried to help me, and they got in touch with my mother, and my mother, I'd been drunk for 2 weeks up there, and my mother gave me the greatest gift she's ever given me since the day I was born. And that's when she kicked me out of her life, and I knew she meant it. And a few days later, after the hotel got through me, I wound up on the streets in Roanoke doing the best I could. On Sunday morning, September 11th, 1957, I was in a back alley in downtown Roanoke on what they called Skid Row there, the market, trying to get a drink of liquor down. I hadn't taken a drink, and I don't know, I guess my moment of truth finally came. It seemed like to me everything stopped moving. Everything. There was complete silence. And God, the thought came to me, well, hell, you're dying from what you're doing. You're dying from what you're doing. And the thought came to me, my God, I'm the only man on God's green earth like me. I thought I was a leper. I didn't know what to do. And I cried out for some help. Maybe it was a coincidence. The only man that knew me in that city on a first-name basis besides the principal was a superintendent of city school. That man had been looking for me for several days. And he didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous or drunks or alcoholics. He just wanted to help a human being because he talked to my mother and found out she wasn't going to help me. And he found me that Sunday morning in that back alley. I didn't take the drink. He carried me to his home. Now, at that stage, I had gotten to the point that I couldn't find oblivion anymore. I hurt all over. My hair hurt. My toenails hurt. You know, sick and tired of being sick. Tired of the high cost of low living, and that's what it is. And he took me to his home, and I couldn't eat. And he got in touch with another man that knew a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was carried to an AA clubhouse that afternoon, a place called the Easy Does It Club. And two men carried me up those steps, and I'll never forget it as long as I live. I wasn't rum dumb. Well, I was rum dumb, but I wasn't drunk. And I just couldn't find that oblivion, and just weak, and I hadn't eaten. And as we got in that room, they began to talk to some members of AA, and by the way, they kind of looked me over. We say we don't look them over when they come in, but by God, you looked me over. And there was an old gentleman standing in the right-hand corner, and he wiggled his finger to me, and I waddled over to him, and he put his arm around my shoulder, and they were talking. And he said to me, son, says, all you got to do is listen to these people and do what they tell you, and you never have to be alone again. This man's name was Old Man John. That's what we call him. He rang my bell. He told me that he gave me the first few lines of chapter 5. Rarely have we seen a person fail who is thoroughly follow our path. That's what he was telling me. And Old Man John rang my bell. And if I could stay there and do what they tell me to do, I didn't have to go out there anymore. And let me tell you about Old Man John. He come to AA when he was 76 years of age. He died at 82 with 6 continuous sobriety. I helped bury him. And he's the man that told me the magic words that I needed that day. That afternoon, they got me in that clubhouse. People began to talk to me a little, and I began to shake a little. And I said something about a drink, and they said, no, we don't do it that way, you know. Then I said something about some tablets, and I thought I'd started a damn revolution. And they said, drink the coffee, drink the coffee. And what I'm about to say is no reflection of who made the coffee this weekend, but I've always said, and I still contend, that there are a hell of a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous making coffee that ain't got no business doing it. And And that was one of those days of that ropey stuff. You know, it just hung. And they said, drink it. And I drank it. I got sick from it. Drank it all afternoon. And they carried me to my first meeting. And that night, I don't know what went on. I remember sitting on my hands. And I remember some of it. But the important thing that I remember, and I shall never forget, is strangers. Strangers. Walking up to me when that meeting was over, and they said, we love you, and we understand, and you're going to be all right. That's all they told me. They didn't ask me where I came from, what I had. They didn't ask me if I had any insurance. They just said, we love you, and we understand, you're going to be all right. And that night, it was proved to me that I didn't have to be alone anymore. Three men got me a room in the YMCA and stayed with me all night long. They took turns sitting on top. They said, if you get too bad, we're going to get a doctor. They didn't nurse me, but they talked to me. And they sat on me a little. And I began to shake and jerk, and I'll never forget it. And they talked to me all night long. The sun was coming up, and one of them said, that's what we try to do. We just try to do it a day at a time, Dave, and maybe you can make it today. I look back at that moment many times. And I remember my memory that morning because I really believe that's when I started to believe that the program or whatever it was would work for me. For when he said, maybe you can make it today, I thought maybe I could, but somewhere in the dark recesses of my mind, I knew one fact that morning. If I was going to make it that day, for some reason or other, I had to be around them to do it. And that's the way I feel about it today. If I make it today, I've still got to be around you to do it. And that next morning, they carried me back to that club, and the man who was introduced to me became my first sponsor. Asked me a lot of questions. All of them were negative answers I gave him. And he said, it seemed to me that you're not doing so hot. And well, I thought about it a little, and I wasn't doing so hot, And he told me some things and told me about the program, and he read the promises. He read the promises to me that morning. And, you know, I began to think, well, what have I got into here? And but as I stand here today, I know what he was talking about because it had been fulfilled in my life. And that man, we began a journey that was to last for about 2 years, him being my sponsor. He got me a room in a boarding house where I lived with six other men. Each one of us had a room there. None of us had a job at one time. The money came from somewhere in AA. My first few months of sobriety, I don't know where it came from, and put clothes on my back. And those six men that I lived with, I learned much from them. We had meetings after meetings. And out of those six men, three of them are dead now on account of going back to drinking. One of them is drinking, and two of us are sober. And I learned much from them. And it wasn't long before, you know, I had a little sobriety and began to think a little. And that's dangerous. I began to get active in the group. And this was a strange group now. And God, I needed it because it wasn't strange. It was just the way it was. They had an inventory room in that building, in that clubhouse. They'd call you in that room, and some of the old timers would sit you down, take your inventory, whether you liked it or not. Just say, come in here, we want to talk to you. And like I was saying the other day in one of the panel meetings, they let me talk after I'd been sober about 9 months. And the steering committee met on it. And what happened, one of the fellows at the house got drunk, and the other fellows brought him to the meeting and propped him up in the back. I thought maybe I needed to help him, so he didn't know what was going on. But I began to give a talk on how not to slip. Never heard of one being done, but I started one, and I'd been going on about 5 minutes. I heard somebody say, sit down. And you know, when you start raving sober, you don't hear that, And so I kept on going. It wasn't long before I heard him say, sit down. And I got ready to go again. And about that time, he came to the podium and led me out of there down that road back to the back row. And well, the old time was set on the back row. They call it Serenity Row. And guess who always sat with them? You know. And as he was leading me down the aisle there, you know, the members' eyes were getting big, you know. Never seen anything like this. And the thought came to me, my God, I got too much power for him tonight, and he don't want me to overdo it. And now, you can begin to think that I had some problems in sobriety, and I did. Because it was long about this time, I was hanging around a bunch of people that were going to meetings off and on, and I was running around with them, and I heard them say something like, well, really, all you need right now is the first step. And I've always said, you know, when you drank and I drank, we drank in different environments. And I adjusted to the environment. I drank in a certain environment. Same thing as in sobriety. I think there are different environments in sobriety. And for a while, I was around the wrong environment because I didn't begin to listen to some people that were losers as far as I'm concerned now as I look back, because most of them got drunk. But I was listening to them. And one night, the old-timers and my sponsor called me in that inventory room after a meeting and sat me down. And I mean, they lit into me, and I got mad, and I resented it. And they told me what I was doing wrong, and my sponsor said, when was the last time you thanked God for a day of sobriety? God, that made me mad, because it had been a long time. And they advised me that if I didn't get a hold of the 12 step, that I was going to get drunk. Now, this is a hell of a thing to tell the backbone of the group that he's going to get drunk. And that's what they were telling me. And I got mad and I left. And as I started out the door, I heard him say that. When's the last time you thanked God for this or that? I went back to that boarding house and I got mad. And you know how we are. The thought of taking a drink didn't cross my mind. But I want to do something to him. I want to do something. You know how it is, and so I sat down. I wrote a written resignation to Alcoholics Anonymous. me! And this is after about a year of sobriety, I guess, when all this is going on. But the end result of that session in that inventory room is as I was sitting there writing this composition. I began to hear my sponsor's voice, an echo. When was the last time you thanked God for a day of sobriety? And it got louder and louder until I was forced to my knees to pray to a God I really didn't know much about when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous after a year and a half sobriety. God, to me, when I first got here, was, you know, more or less a question in the sky. Maybe yes, maybe no. By the result of this prayer that afternoon, that night, I was able to walk into a bathroom and look in a mirror at myself for the first time in my adult life and really know what I was, that I was just a speck on this universe, that someday I'd die and soon be forgotten. And the only way I had to go was through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I tried everything else. So the next night I went back. I didn't take a drink, but I rejoined Alcoholics Anonymous. And I became a member of the clique, and if you want to know who the clique is, get there sometime before the meeting starts and see who does the work. I started doing those things I was asked to do, and I got a hold of those steps, and I asked for some help, and they led me. And things got a little bit better, and it was in this animal that I've often said I've learned much more from people of less education than I. The man that solved my employment problem had a third grade education. They called me in that inventory room one night to talk to me about, I didn't have a job, to talk to me about my, what I needed to do. And had some rather elite men in there, I thought, a banker, and one was a contractor, and two successful businessmen and a lawyer. And Red was in there, a sign painter. And they began to discuss my past and what I should do. And Red spoke up and said, Dave, it seems to me that if you studied engineering in college, that's what you ought to be doing in life. Well, hell, nobody ever explained to me that way before. And so through Red's help and Sue. My present wife, Sue, I'd met her after I'd been sober about 3 months. She said that's when she did her social work. She's not an alcoholic. She's not a member of Al-Anon. But she's been a God's gift to me because she's helped me in this program. And at that time, one day, I had an interview over at the highway department in Roanoke, over Salem, Virginia, next door, and they went with me, Red and Sue, and I went in and had this interview, told the man the truth. You know, there's no resistance against the truth when you don't tell lies. And the man was completely amazed, and he said, well, if you're willing to help yourself, we're willing to help you too, whatever what he had told me. And he said, this was the middle of December, 57. When can you go to work? I said, well, I've got a lot of business to tend to. You know, I was scared to death. And I said, I can go to work about the 1st of February. He said, fine. I said, come on back and we'll put you to work 1st of February. In the engineering that I'd studied. And I went on back out to the car. They were outside. How did it go? I told them. When did they tell you to go to work? I told them what happened. They carried my butt right back in there. I've been working. Started work that afternoon. And God, it's tough, I tell you. So things got better, and it wasn't long before I had close to 2 years sobriety. And my first sponsor was a man that really, really believed in the book and knew the steps, and that was my basics. And I got ready to go back to North Carolina, my home state, because of the fact I wanted to get a divorce so I could marry Sue. And I was employed when I got there. I went with the highway department. And a man I'd met him one time before in Roanoke when he was traveling there, and he agreed to be my sponsor. And so I went to Raleigh. This man took me over. And God, this was another grace. Another coincidence, this man was one of the first 100 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a native New Yorker. He was a close friend of Bill. He knew the book. He knew the steps, and he didn't know but one way, and that was the right way. And he taught me an awful lot about service. He's the man that got me interested in service, and that's how I got to meet staff people in my early sobriety. I'd go with him to conventions, and he'd introduce me to these people. And he gave me a great lesson about talking behind one of these things. I'd been sober about, in that group, when I moved to Raleigh, the old Hayes Barton group, they had an inventory room too. And Tom was one of these people that he'd talk to you, he'd make you sit down, you stood up, and he talked down at you. And so we got in that inventory room, he said, what's the problem? And he said, I'd been going to some of these conventions and watching these people hugging, kissing, and the speakers got through and they clapped like hell. And I said, I think I'm a convention speaker. I can't repeat what he said, but a moratorium was put on my speaking behind the podium for 3 years. He said, from now on, you can speak in discussion meetings, and that's it. You're not to speak in an open meeting until I tell you. Well, and so we trudged this road of happy destiny, and I went on about my business, and some time passed, and it was about 2.5, close to 3 years later, and one day he called me and said, come over to the house, I want to talk to you and bring Sue with you. I said, oh, hell, what have I done now? And we go over, and they get in one room, Margaret and Sue, and he calls me to the other room, sits me down, and he stands up and talks down at me. And he said, Dave, says, I want to tell you something. He says, you're going down to Columbia, South Carolina to talk at a state convention. Before you go, there's some things I want to tell you. You do this, you do this, you do this. Before you go, there's something else you want to know. They asked me to go first. I can't go, and you're going as a damn substitute, and don't you ever forget it, as long as you live. So I just feel like I'm a substitute, and that's the way it's been with me, because anything I know about the program, I learned from other people in Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book, my home group, and through sponsorship. I've been blessed in my sobriety. I got to Raleigh and got involved in service later on and got involved with sponsoring people and working the program. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about, helping other people. And I don't know, it may be somebody here this weekend that, like I was, after about 1.5 years, you begin to wonder about this thing, will it work? What is this thing called Alcoholic Anonymous? What is this thing called sobriety? I really believe the core and guts of this whole program is based on one word, and that's the truth. Or more briefly, you got to be honest with yourself. I heard a man say years ago at some meeting, said, when Jesus Christ walked the face of the earth in the body of a man, he didn't say, I'm a truthful man. He said, I am the truth. I believe it's from this source and this root that we inherited the problem called Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I've seen enough in my time and age not only to believe but to know that there is a power behind this universe that stands ready to help you and I if we're willing to help ourselves. In the beginning, I called it the man upstairs. And today, I call it the God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, the God that I found through your love for me. My mother, it was 9.5 years before my mother would ever take me back into her life as a son. After I got sober, she didn't believe it. She came to see one time up in Roanoke, and she wasn't too impressed with AA. Took 9.5 years, and for a while there, I'd go down to my hometown to visit, and I'd have to go up to old JT, that old timer I told you about. Spend some time, and my wife tried to intervene and help, my sponsor tried to, and nothing would help. But after 9.5 years, through some circumstances, some people went to see my mother to tell her about the program of AA. And later on, she asked me to forgive her for what she'd done to me in my sobriety. Maybe it was a coincidence. This woman later became the greatest friend that Alcoholics Anonymous ever had. And she lived to see me sober 32 years. I'm grateful for that. Well, you know, I've been sober for a period of time, and in spite of being sober, and I think it's God-given, the sobriety I've been given, I find that in my life there's still certain things I still have to do. And it starts out, the first thing I still have to do is I have to continue to have a monumental desire to work this program and work at my sobriety. You know, when I came to you that first night, I told you I was willing to go in any length to get this program. They asked me that. That's what my first sponsor asked me. He asked me, said, do you want to quit drinking forever? And God, I knew what forever was. Will you do what we tell you to do? Do you want to quit drinking worse than anything else on God's green earth? And will you go to any length to do it? And I did. I wanted, and I still have to remember that. Sometimes when that telephone rings in the middle of the night and somebody wants some help, I begin to think, wonder if they could work after breakfast. Those three men, that first night, they didn't dump me off at that YMCA and say, we'll be back after breakfast. No, thank God. And that thought is still there. The second thing I have to do is I have to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, that's where it's at. That's where we sit down and share among individual egos and survive. And I think that's what it is sometimes, surviving among individual egos. And it's the little people. I've been surrounded. I sponsor a lot of people. I don't sponsor women anymore, I'll tell you that. And but I'll tell you, I sponsored a couple one time, Vernon and Gertrude. Vernon had trouble off and on, ought to have more sobriety than me. Gertrude was our state gala delegate at one time and later had trouble, and she's been sober now about 12 years. When I first started sponsoring them, they had been married about 6 years. And one Christmas Eve night, we were having a meeting, and they let me lead the meeting. Christmas Eve, wasn't many people there. We were on the 8th step. And we had a good meeting, I thought. And they didn't have a driver's license. I had to carry them everywhere they went. And I was getting ready to carry them home after the meeting. Got in the car, and now we'd been on the 8th step. And Gertrude says to Vernon, said, Vernon, they'd been married 6 years. When are you going to make some amends to me? And Vernon spoke up, says, honey, you're not even on my list. And now, these are the kind of people I had to be around and I was surrounded with. I said, you work with those people and you will either get drunk or you'll stay sober one. And I managed to stay sober. They were great people. The third thing I have to do is I try to have to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's the program. You heard it this weekend. I know it. If there's anybody here that's new, maybe like I was after a few weeks in AA, I was one of these smart people. You know, I had to argue against the steps some. And they'd sit there and look at me and laugh. And but I'll save you some time. That's the program. That's the program, the 12 steps. It tells me that, you know, it says in our book, we're granted a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And I happen to know that as long as I've been trying to work these 12 steps in my life, even today, that my spiritual condition has improved. And I found the God of my understanding. That's what it's all about. And then some days, the fourth thing I have to do, and you know what I'm talking about. Some days I just have to hang on and do the best I can. And there have been days like that. I had some ups and downs in my sobriety. There's been some sad times. I went through an experience a year ago, and day to day when I get up every morning, I thank God that I'm alive. I thank God I'm sober. And I thank God that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And God has been looking after me over the years. I know that. I just have to do the best I can. You know what I'm talking about. And so it seemed to me that when I say that, it's kind of like the program we had the other day. Yesterday is my experience, and tomorrow is my hope. And today is going from one to the other and doing the best I can. And as long as I can walk hand in hand with you down this happy road of destiny that we speak of, I too believe that I'll be allowed another day of sobriety, one day at a time. Is it a coincidence that this Don and I, over the years, we were together? Is it a coincidence that we are here this morning and friends of another? Or is it a coincidence that we gather together, you know, kind of a celebration of our sobriety? Well, if it is a coincidence, I'd have found a coincidence of act of God in the midst of time. The same God that has been doing for you and I that which we could not do for ourselves. God the Father of all mankind. In closing, I'd like to give you a few simple words. I think it's some of the most powerful language in the big book. I used to claim it was mine, but some people in my group started reading the book right thoroughly. And I can stand up here and I could have started and just give you these few lines, and it would have told my story and probably yours, because it is the story of a sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous. And it goes something like this. This great experience that released me from the bondage of hatred and replaced it with love is just another affirmation of truth I know. I get everything I need in Alcoholics Anonymous, and everything I need I get. And when I get what I need, I invariably find that it was just what I wanted all the time. Thank you, and God bless you.